Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. We've got something a little bit different for you today. Zach on presenting duties and I'm joined by Beth. Beth, how are you doing?
I'm good, Zach. I don't think we've done one of these yet together, us two, which considering we are history siblings, this is a travesty.
It is. But I think it's probably because up until now, Alex hasn't trusted us not to just dissolve into fits of giggles. But we're doing something that's cute rather than giggly, which is why you're an ideal person to have on this as our kind of resident history expert and purveyor of all things cuteness. So we're looking today at the history of dogs, specifically lap dogs, in the 19th century. Introduce our guest for us.
Yeah. So as Zach has said, cute, giggly, fun. This just sounds wonderful. And I'm really, really excited for this one. So we're joined by Dr. Stephanie Howard-Smith, who is a member of the Pet Histories and Wellbeing Project at Royal Holloway. And she's a research associate in the Centre for 18th Century Studies at York as well. And she wrote her PhD on lap dogs and their place in 18th century culture, and has written articles on attempts to control rabies outbreaks in mid-18th century London and the trade of porcelain pugs in the 18th century, which just sounds absolutely fascinating. I'd never thought about the trade of porcelain pugs before, but welcome, Stephanie.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Shall we start with the absolute basics for this one, because I'm not sure most people have really thought through the role of dogs in history much beyond kind of working dogs, which isn't so much what we're going to look at today. So what's the traditional perception of the role of the dog in the family, and when do we start to see lap dogs particularly becoming a big part of the family unit?
So lots of people, when it comes to dog history, tend to concentrate on the Victorian period. And if you think about that idea of the family dog in your head, it's something like a Landseer painting of like a Victorian family with all the kids and the dogs there and everyone's getting on very well. And there are lots of changes that happen in pet keeping culture in the Victorian period. Not least you've got kind of like the development of the pedigree dog, all that kind of stuff's going on. But there's a much longer history of keeping dogs companionship. I think one of the problems is that sometimes it's quite difficult to separate companionship out from other tasks. So just because you go hunting with a dog doesn't mean your dog's not a companion in some other way. And you have Roman dog burials where there's evidence of dog sacrifice, but then that's not to say that those dogs weren't loved before someone like wrung their neck. It's complicated. And relationships with companion dogs are really specific to time and place. So the West is only one place where dog keeping has emerged as a practice. And research only focuses on dogs in the West. My research does too, but there are different kind of ways of doing this. So in South America, there's a tradition of keeping, I don't know how to pronounce it, but iagüs, which are basically like a pets you adopt at birth and you kind of keep them with in the family. They can be dogs, they can be anything, but they're raised in the family. In the Pacific, dogs were kept and raised in the family, sometimes fed breast milk, but ultimately killed for their meat. China and Japan have their own traditions of dog keeping, which are, I think, particularly China, there's not very much scholarship on them. So there's a really long history about it. But going back to the West, so the Roman period is when you start seeing lots of little companion dogs being kept. They tend to have names that we'd recognise now, things like Fluffy, Fly, Pearl, names that you'd kind of give your dog today if you had one. And it's basically what you expect to see. They're women's dogs or children's dogs. People talk about how lovely they are and how much they love them, but also how yappy and annoying they are too. So there's a really, really long history of keeping lap dogs. And it stretches from that point on into the medieval period, where they're women's pets and the clergyman's pets. Right up through the early modern period, where you have people talking about puppies. That's the name for the lap dogs, then puppies. And again, it's lots of kind of stereotypes we have with lap dogs now. They're little dogs, women keep them, they bark, they're annoying, women spend more attention on their dogs than they would otherwise. And then in the mid-17th century, suddenly people start using the word lap dog to describe these dogs. And that's where everything really picks off, and especially in terms of criticism too.
I can absolutely imagine that Beth would call her dog Fluffy. Even if it wasn't Fluffy, you should just call it Fluffy for the sake of it. I'm curious about what you say about the association with women, though. Is this a kind of, is there kind of tropes about gender tied in with all of this? Or should a man, inverted commas, have a certain type of dog? And if you have other types of dog, other breeds of dog, then you're less masculine?
This was definitely 100% the case in the 18th century, where there was a really set idea about the kind of pets that were appropriate for each kind of person to have. And lap dogs are very much a woman's pet, and not necessarily a good woman's pet. I think the ideal period to have one was maybe if you're a young girl, because they're kind of seen as practice for motherhood, and they're kind of, you can nurture it and look after it. But you don't want to have one for too long or pay it too much attention, because that means maybe you're not spending as much attention on your husband and your kids as you should be on your dog. Yes, absolutely women's pets, associated with elite, wealthy women, fashionable women. And if you did have a dog and you're a man, a lap dog and you're a man, that was problematic, and associated, because they were so closely associated with women. All kinds of stereotypes come with that. I think you still see that even today. These are things that we still have these weird stereotypes about small dogs, despite the fact that practically these days not different at all from other dogs. Like, most people keep Rottweilers or Alsatians, Border Collies or Spaniels, and they're not going to go out and do the jobs those dogs are meant to do. They're pet dogs. But we still have a weird thing about dogs that are historically bred for companionship and were, and a little, and yeah, a whole load of weird ideas attached to that.
I really love what you said just about them, like, have small girls having lap dogs as like pretend babies. It's like having a baby doll now, I suppose, isn't it? It's like that continuation of that, I suppose. So your research really is really quite fascinating. There's so much that you can talk about when, you know, it's a topic that I wouldn't be able to tell you anything about, but there's so much when you start to get into it. So let's start with some of your work on the efforts about controlling rabies, the outbreaks in London in 1760. There was a cull, wasn't there, in response to the outbreak, which is not unusual, but this one's different. Why is it different to the others?
So just a bit of background, I think it's really easy to forget that rabies is ever a problem in Britain, because it hasn't been for hundreds of years, and it's easy to assume that it was never a problem. So rabies was endemic in Britain until the early 20th century, and there were sporadic outbreaks. And like you said, usually the way of dealing with this was culling, because until Pasteur invented the rabies vaccine, there was no reliable way of controlling it at all. The best you could do was cauterize your wound and hope that you wouldn't get affected. But obviously, if you did get infected, you'd have the worst death imaginable. So it's something you really want to avoid. And so it makes sense that in the face of a disease like that, you would do everything possible to avoid it, firstly, infecting livestock, because that's an economic problem, and also infecting people, because that's a big problem. So, but what happens in the 1760 outbreak is that the cull starts unofficially. It's something that local people want to happen. So it's a kind of grassroots thing. And then the City of London's Common Council declare a cull in late August, which is all going totally normally. But suddenly, in the days after the cull was declared, you get a massive outpouring of letters opposing the cull to London newspapers, and also people writing to their friends about it. And they're suddenly, whereas in the past culls happened, it was kind of an accepted part of life, now there's a problem with it. So some of the things they say are kind of logical criticisms of the cull, like basically it's fake news, that there's not a rabies problem. And it's all been kind of whipped up by the newspapers. And this seems to have been the case a bit, because the newspapers would have published retractions for various claims. Secondly, they would make kind of this really old argument that you still hear today, that if someone's willing to violently beat an animal to death, they might hurt humans down the line too. And that's a kind of a really old idea. But what's totally new, really, in the 1760 cull, are all the people who write in and say, dogs are good. Why do you want to kill dogs? We love them. They do all this stuff for us. And sometimes it's tasks like labour and shepherding and all that kind of thing. But it's also, they keep us company, that our lives wouldn't be the same without them, and we owe them something. And you also see kind of a continuation of that, just like people say, you know, some humans are bad, does that mean we should kill all humans? And this kind of really weird extreme logic, which kind of is more common today but wasn't really common at the time. And people would talk about the cull in terms of it being a murder of dogs, and that's, murder is usually a legal term, it's like humans, dogs, pets, and make really weird comparisons. So for instance, people would often compare the cull to the Slaughter of Innocents. The mayor of London was compared to King Herod, and people make comparisons between the colours and Native Americans, and this is during the French and Indian War. So they're kind of going for these kind of the most extreme examples of savagery they can think of, I say they inverted commas, when they're trying to oppose the cull. So yeah, suddenly dogs are good, people are bad, and we need to be protecting, in terms of what the opponents of the cull are saying, our best friends, the dog, compared to problematic humans.
Why now though? I mean, what's so different in 1760? Is this kind of Age of Enlightenment thinking? Are people thinking differently about their relationship with nature? Is it just that dogs have become a much more central part of the family unit by this point than they had been previously? What's new here to create this new response?
I think it's a combination of all those things. Like, at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, you see the development of the animal welfare movement. In the 1820s, you see things like the RSPCA being founded. I think all this stuff is a preamble to that. I think one of the biggest influences on this movement generally is the idea of sentimentality and sensibility. The idea that in expressing emotion, you kind of demonstrate your superior feeling. The idea that to be a good human, you need to be a kind human, and kind especially to people and animals who are more vulnerable than you are. And I think the cull is one very easy way to demonstrate that. You can come up with these kind of overwrought expressions of, oh God, the street's full of dog's blood, how awful it is, it makes me cry thinking about it, that kind of emotion. So I think it's just this moment, the mid 18th century, is at the juncture of an older way of thinking about animals, not, I don't want to generalize here, but kind of utilitarian way of thinking about animals, and a kind of a preamble to a 19th century Victorian sentimental, affectionate relationship with dogs in particular.
I mean, this is really interesting, but I'm conscious that there are lots of things that we need to talk about here, because there are so many interesting topics within it. We mentioned, or Beth mentioned at the start, about your work on the trade in porcelain models of dogs. Now, I don't want to spoil it for people, but when I read your conclusions, it really turned some ideas on their head for me. I mean, I was kind of literally kind of sitting back scratching my head a little bit. So talk us through what you found out in terms of these completely wrong associations that we have, and about kind of the notions of pug popularity that are embedded in your study.
So pugs were a really popular variety of lapdog in the 18th century. They're one of these dogs that kind of comes in booms of popularity, just like there was 10 years ago, where everyone suddenly was all over pugs. It was like that in the early 18th century. And one of the things that's also different about the 18th century compared to earlier periods is that this is the period of the consumer society. The pug was really a multimedia sensation. This is the first time a dog became a multimedia sensation. The reason that happened is because the Meissen factory outside Dresden, which was the first place where hard-paste porcelain was discovered in Europe after a really long and protracted period trying to work out the way to make it, began producing porcelain pug models. This is largely because they had a patron of sorts, the Graf von Bruhl, who loved pugs. He had them, and it was a way to kind of curry favour with him. They'd make these little pug porcelain models up. And because Meissen was so prestigious itself, when they went to other places in Europe, people, they kind of crossed borders, local porcelain factories would begin making them themselves. So when I started looking at this, one of the kind of things I expected to see would be an association between China and the porcelain pug, because China also made copies of these porcelain pugs. And even if you don't know much about dogs, you probably know that pugs are from China. But as I researched this, it turned out this wasn't the case at all. In the 18th century, they're very much thought of as a Dutch dog, maybe from, if you want to push it, maybe from like the Low Countries generally, or Germany or Denmark, but they're a Northern European dog. And the association with China came much later, probably because of the porcelain trade and them was so effective and popular. But there's a historian, Qi Ming Yang, who's looked at people writing about porcelain pugs in the 19th century. And she notes the way that the pug, the way people talked about it, the Victorians talked about it, was really racialized. And it continues to be to this day. Really quite disturbing connections made between pugs and the place they supposedly come from, but actually don't come from. But I think it's one of the interesting ways that dog history can be more relevant, because what I noticed is that lots of scientists were basing their kind of historical context for their genome studies off breed books written in the 19th century, early 20th century, which don't really use sources properly, kind of make spurious claims without really backing them up. But because this was written in the books and the claims were repeated and repeated and repeated, I emailed a scientist and he said he just had no clue that there was, that pugs could be from anywhere else other than China. So this is one of the ways that dog history maybe has slightly wider implications, apart from the fact that lots of people live with dogs and they mean a lot to us in our personal lives. But so pugs, not where you thought they came from, and extremely, extremely popular in the 18th century until they weren't, and they almost went extinct for a bit in Britain, and they came back up again, and they go away again, they come back up again, and so on and so forth.
Is that almost like, it almost sounds like we say they come in and out of fashion, as it were. It is almost like a trend, isn't it? Rather than being a dog, it's the trend of having a pug rather than having a dog, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and this is something that makes people kind of comfortable even today, we don't like to think about dogs being accessories or trends because they mean so much to us, but they are, and they have been for a really long time. I think the point where people today and in the 18th century find it disturbing is at what point it's just a fashion statement. And it absolutely was for lots of people. You have to have the in dog at some points in the 18th century. It's a pug, later might be a Newfoundland, it might be a Pomeranian, but they come in and out of fashion. And so not only are they fashion statements in themselves, they're meta luxuries, because here's a luxury thing, a pug or another kind of lap dog, and you can also give it clothes, which people did. You can give it cushions, which people did. You can feed it tea, give it snuff, feed it roasted meats, all this kind
of... Sorry, hang on. Give a dog snuff?
Yes, there was a pug, apparently had a vitiated taste for snuff. And if you'd hold your snuff box open, this dog would come up and sniff it. But I don't know how that happened. Obviously, how do you come to the point where you let your dog do that? But yeah, it made the newspaper.
Oh, I've heard some ridiculous things in my time.
Yeah.
I mean, people, you know, feeding their dogs venison, and you have situations where dogs are better clothed and better fed than their owners ever are. And they're almost kind of bankrupting themselves because of the money they're pouring into their dog. But to give your dog drugs, which is fundamentally what snuff is.
I'd have loved to see that pug. Like, would it have been, because pugs are quite like energetic dogs anyway, aren't they? Could you imagine it was on speed or something? It would just be completely flying all over the place. I'd pay good money to see that.
See, Beth isn't concerned about the welfare of poor snuff-infused dog. She just wants to see it chasing its tail like a
reaction. It's the kind of thing you see on like social media, isn't it? It's like, wasn't there that video, oddly enough, of a pug 10 years ago where he was floppy all over the place and he couldn't run in a straight line, and it's the spectacle of it, I suppose, isn't it? Spectacle is a big thing for humans, isn't it? We like a bit of spectacle.
Yeah, and like if you were out for a fun evening at Sadler's Wells in the 18th century, one of the things you could go and see was a troop of dancing dogs. and they dance. Yeah, exactly. It's exactly the same thing. It's like Pudsey from Britain's Got Talent, but, you know, reliably almost there, always all the time. And they kind of react with little masquerades and they perform pantomimes and you, as well as dancing. So there's a fun evening out for the family, the dancing pug, the dancing dog troupe. So I don't know if they were ever given snuff though.
There is a darker side though, isn't there, in the kind of world of dog entertainment, which is pitting dogs against dogs in fights and then gambling on the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And dog fighting was very popular in the 18th century and it continues to be so in the 19th century. Although interestingly, one of the things I found is that sometimes the dog doctor who would attend to the fighting dogs in the ring would also attend to the dogs, this is in the 19th century now, would also attend to the dogs in Mayfair when they were poorly too. So sometimes the worlds between dog fighting and high living society dogs did cross over. And to a certain extent, the pedigree dog world is in some ways an outcome of that. Originally, the first dog shows were really popular with the kind of London's working class rather, and then only later it became a more of a high society, middling sort activity.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that. So the kind of the, there are certain words I'm deliberately trying to avoid here so it's not to offend people, but the kind of certain class of individual who takes a profound interest in the length of a dog's snout and all these other things that folks care about in the discussions of pedigree, etc. So that was initially a working class thing?
Sort of, yeah. So in the 18th century, you do have people breeding their dogs together and being quite careful about it. I'm talking about the elite here. They, you know, you'd write and be like, oh, Fluffy is looking very lovely. You know what? She looks just like my dog, Adonis. Oh, their puppies would be so cute. We should definitely get them together and make this a reality. And the same with hunting dogs. People were very careful. There are all these letters where dogs on heat get out and then they worry that they've mated with the mongrel from down the road. So people were careful about it. But yeah, that very 19th century breed standards, you know, how long's your dog whiskers kind of thing, does have roots in these first early dog shows, which were held largely in London pubs in the East End and Elephant Castle and places like that. So yeah.
But again, that's just, I would never even have thought that it went that far back. And you know, wow, it's just amazing. And Stephanie, a lot of your work has been on this concept of lap dogs and where they came from. And why focus on the lap dog, first of all? What brought you to that, I suppose, that area of study?
So the first thing that kind of drew me in is I like dogs. I was brought up around dogs. And about the time I started an MA in 18th century studies, my family got a pug. So in some ways there's an embodied history there because I came more aware of it's a different way of being with dogs. Like they're always around you. They sleep on you all the time. It's very kind of intense relationship. Also of all the stereotypes people had about them. So you like, having comments about handbag dogs and all that kind of stuff. So they're good Christians you made at pugs. So I'll just point this out. They are unhealthy and there's a conversation that could be had about that, but also just, yeah, things that had nothing to do with that. Like, yeah, oh, you've got a handbag dog, that's a step down from the Labrador, that kind of stuff. So I became more aware of that from that point of view. Also, when I was doing the research beforehand, I was seeing all these breed books and they come with, like, if you get the pugs, the dummy's guide to pugs, it'll have a bit of history in the beginning. And I remember reading and thinking, well, this seems a bit off, I should really look into this. So that's how it kind of started in a not very professional way at all. And yeah, so that was the interest initially, but they're a really interesting subject for study because they're the first dogs that are really just kept for companionship. And you can tell when someone's talking about a lap dog, is that the chances are it's not going to be performing any other functions. That makes it different from other dogs. So within the household, it's got a different function. It's allowed in different places. It's given different food. Like I said, it's given snuff in very exceptional circumstances. People have a different relationship with them. And at the same time, because of that, the discourse around them is very different to other dogs. Like, whereas other dogs are good and noble and loyal, people write about lap dogs, and even in natural history books in the 18th century, in very trying to think of the best way to say this, negative ways. So pugs are selfish, lapdogs are sneaky, they're manipulative. People use really, intense language to describe them. So there's a sense that lapdogs are different and lesser to other dogs. And the combination of these things together makes lapdogs in the industry a really interesting way for people to talk about other people, a really easy way to talk about things like animal sentience and morality and luxury and women and how much kindness you should reasonably give an animal at a time when people are still kind of working out what kindness to animals means in society generally.
Well, let's dig into that then. You know, what kind of processes, what responses, I guess, do people have to this growing adoption of these dogs into the home? Because there is, I don't know. I mean, I was about to say, well, there is a kind of a culture shift. I'm not entirely sure that that's a fair comment to make, because I'm thinking of the King Charles Spaniel, which is not really a working dog. It's a dog that's bred to, in my opinion, just look absolutely adorable. You know, mini spaniel, how can you not love it? We're getting off topic very rapidly. Take Zach away from discussion of spaniels. How do people respond to this? Is it something that, you know, it's been happening anyway, or is there sort of an explosion that then creates a counter reaction to this embracing of the dog in the home?
So you're absolutely right that it wasn't a totally new sensation. On the spaniel side of things, it's really important to note that Charles II's spaniels gave birth in his bed and would whelp their puppies in his bed. And when he comes over, when he lands for his restoration, Pepys is there, and Pepys notes that the dog the king brought with him, quote unquote, shat the boat. So the dogs are like an omnipresent part of, yeah, obviously dogs are really important to King Charles.
That's it, Pepys.
I know, isn't it? It's great. And also Pepys is also weird about his own bitch. He gets very jealous of it when it begins mating with other dogs, which is a whole other thing.
Oh, that's again very Pepys.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, so I think for the 18th century, one of the differences maybe is kind of the rising power of the middling sort, who find the whole lapdog thing a bit gross and weird and a waste of money. So what makes the 18th century different, I think, is the explosion of print culture and material and literary culture. So if more people are writing more stuff and more different kinds of people are writing those kinds of things, you'll have this a different perspective on things like that. And like the criticism is really ramped up. I mean, people are really, really uncomfortable with these dogs. So as much as some people loved them and gave them all these special privileges, on the other hand, you have people talking about them in terms of decadence. You know, there are all these poems written about women who keep their dogs in the bed rather than their husbands. If you've read Mansfield Park, you'll know that Lady Bertram has a pug which she like loves more than her own children. And these kind of lapdog owning neglectful mothers are everywhere in 18th century fiction. So there's a sense that for people who aren't fans of them, the lapdog is kind of turning up the natural order of things. It's usurping children's place in the home. It's distracting people from their natural roles. If I know you're into your Napoleonic history, there's the story. Yeah, well, here we go. This is one of my favorite lapdog anecdotes. So Josephine de Beauharnais had a pug called Fortuné. Yeah, and supposedly, on their wedding night, he asked her to get the dog off the bed, and she was like, well, no, he's been here the whole time, so you're just gonna have to share. And so Napoleon begins to get in bed, and Fortuné bites him.
I remember this story now, yes.
Yeah, so there's an epilogue to this story, which is that sadly, Fortuné dies while Napoleon's on tour in Italy. The cook's son's dog kills him. The dog's picking fights with everyone, and obviously it's a pug, so it can't defend itself properly. So the cook's dog kills Fortuné. And there's a story that a few days later that Napoleon's walking around and the cook's saying, it's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I can't believe my dog killed your dog. And Napoleon's like, oh, don't sweat it. And you know what? Josephine's got another dog now, so if you could bring your dog around, because I actually don't like this one.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So just to reiterate, for the sake of, you know, I mean, I have a habit of bashing Napoleon. He is now the heartless person who doesn't care about other dogs being killed and actively encourages the death of his wife's pets. So there you go, yet another reason to hate Napoleon.
Who'd have thought it, Isaac? Who'd have thought that Napoleon was a horrible person?
Oh, me, absolutely. Who says that you can't bend history?
But it's the story, it originally comes from one of Napoleon's friends who, you know, did like dogs, because he put in a birth announcement into one of the Paris newspapers to announce that his dog had had puppies. But he didn't know, say it was a dog, so that really confused everyone for a bit. But yeah, so there you go. Napoleon, noted pug hater. If you need another reason.
Heartless individual. Heartless, deplorable. We really need to get off this, otherwise I'll go off onto a rant about Napoleon.
Stop it, Zach. Shush. No, stop.
Why are you treating me like a dog now?
It's too easy. right, back onto... Right, Zach, be sensible. Stop it. So these perceptions that you talked about, and as you said, they're not actually unheard of even today, are they? These perceptions of... you know, giving animals human characteristics and being selfish and this. How do these perceptions from the 18th century translate into the present day? Do we still see the echoes of it in the same way that would have happened during the 18th century?
I think in lots of ways you do. Like, if you close your eyes and you imagined a small, fluffy white dog and you're told to imagine its owner, you'd probably assume they're a woman. Like, even though there's no reason to assume that anymore. That's also true of cats, maybe to a certain extent, which is also weird and also has roots in the 18th century and going back. So absolutely. First up, we have these stereotypes that lapdogs are women's pets, despite, like I said, not having a real, particularly different role compared to other dogs, is still really prevalent. Same way, society still makes assumptions about why a man might want to own a small fluffy dog, which are wrong, and it's still rooted in these really old ideas about proper dogs being big and useful and good, and little dogs being manipulative and fawning, which is weird because I don't think they're particularly fawning, but that there you go. I think also if you think in films, like if a dog, little dogs die more frequently than big dogs do, and when they do, it's usually in comic violence in the way that you wouldn't really do for a big dog. So I think these ideas are still everywhere. Also, people seem to act as if spending money on a dog's new, and it's not, obviously it was just for the elite in the 18th century. But like you said, you know, the idea that today they're dogs who are looked after better than people was the case in the 18th century, and people like to kind of write stories about social decadence into, like, you know, oh god, our whole society is going down the drain because someone bought Fufu a luxury coat or something like that, when we've been doing it for a really, really, really long time. It's not necessarily a good thing, but it doesn't mean that society is going to crumble at any given moment. Although Jeremy Bentham writes a letter to his brother where basically he compares the Earl of Carlisle writing an epitaph for his dog, and he said he compares it to, you know, Gibbon writing about the end of Rome. He says it's just social decadence. So there's a really, really long history about that, and spending money on dogs rather than on people and being uncomfortable about it. So absolutely, we still have these weird, really outdated ideas about what dogs are appropriate for different people.
So I was going to ask, is there sort of, are there echoes of antiquity within those perceptions? And, you know, is there this idea that if you go back in history, then dogs have been bred for hunting, for war, and then in time for protective purposes, so to protect livestock and then to herd livestock in the form of sheepdogs. But you kind of tapped into that already. The other thing I want to ask, and perhaps we'll deal with this in a moment, is dog fashion. You've got to tell us what is in the 18th century in terms of dressing up your dog. So take that in whatever order you want to, but we've got to have answers to that.
Okay, dog fashion first. Lady Penrhyn, who was the wife of Lord Penrhyn, who owned Penrhyn Castle in Wales, also a slave owner, a really anti-abolition, anti-ending slave trade person, she had a pack of pugs again, and there were stories about them going out into Grosvenor Square dressed in matching red cloaks with little bonnets on them. So that's up there, cloaks and bonnets in crimson dye. In terms of other kinds of fashions, I mean, if you, the thing to really have, if you can afford it, is a dog bed, especially if you're living in France. You can get really amazing dog beds. There's one that the master joiner made for Marie Antoinette. It's in the Met. It's got a detachable roof. Just, I don't know why you might want to see what your dog's doing inside this little miniature kennel. I don't know. Others had a seat on top so you could sit on top. It's like a kind of multifunctional piece of furniture. There's also, yeah, so I think furniture up there, clothes, you want a kind of cloaked bonnet deal, ideally in a really bright colour. And collars, definitely collars, preferably Moroccan leather. The ones in Mice and Pugs always have bells on the back, which I quite like personally.
Oh, this is very swish. All I can think of though now is the pug, oddly enough, because he is a lap dog, isn't he? The pug in Pocahontas, Percy.
Percy, I feel really strongly about that, yeah. And if you think about it, Percy's an awful dog to begin with.
Yeah.
Because he's so pampered. He has that little carousel with the bones on it. I mean, I wish that existed. That'd be really cool. But yeah, so Percy, I think an anachronistic pug there. A bit early, really, but I'll take it. Also, there's also pugs in one of the Hobbit films. I just can't understand why they're a cast there. If it's supposed to be like a kind of medieval, they're in the floating town. I don't know why they're there. It really bothers me. That was a total segue into absolutely nothingness there. But yeah,
No worries. We do this all the time on History. Credit to Beth for managing to shoehorn a Disney film into this conversation. She does it every single time. Incredible. I now need to go and rewatch The Desolation of Smaug in order to spot these pugs. But yeah, back to the historical side of things, the antiquity link or otherwise, to what extent is am I just talking rubbish when I kind of say, is there a kind of hang up about working dogs and the function, you know, dogs are bred for a purpose originally humans, and then that translates into the prejudices that we see later on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely a part of it. I don't know if you've seen that meme where it's a wolf and the wolf's being like, oh, I'm really hungry, there's a fire, oh, they've got some meat, what's the worst that could happen if I go over there? And then the end result is a pug wearing a birthday hat. So I think like this is exactly what people were worried about in the 18th century as well, to a certain extent. Pugs weren't as deformed then as they are now, but they were still considered to be, a bit deformed. And people would talk about some of the changes in dogs in terms of decadence, like Mary Wollstonecraft didn't like dogs with pendulous ears. She thought it was a sign of domestic servitude. So I think absolutely, I think particularly now we're really, sometimes there's a good reason to worry about what we've done to dogs in the terms of extreme breed conformation. But yeah, I think, yeah, this kind of misty-eyed idea of a past with a hunting dog, and this is what dogs are supposed to be, even if most people don't go hunting with their dogs. Maybe like the idea that they could do, which I think maybe there's a kind of macho, I don't know, impulse to be considered there.
Well, they're still doing it at this time, aren't they? I mean, I'm thinking, sorry, Napoleonic War reference incoming, about Wellington. He has a pack of hounds with him sent out to Spain, where he's commanding the British armies, for the purpose of giving him entertainment, and they chase down hares. And Wellington's obsessed with hunting, you know, that he can see it. There's a famous anecdote about how he's deep in conversation with one of his subordinate generals, and he sees a pack of hounds chasing a hare, completely stops talking to the guy that he's in conversation with, lets out this cheer, rides off for about an hour following these hounds as they try and chase down this hare, and then calmly goes back and finds the guy who's gone off to other business and continues his conversation. So what I'm getting at is that, you know, you've got the two happening in conjunction with one another during this period.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so hunting was super popular, all kinds of hunting, like fox hunting in particular. I think, yeah, exactly. So the kind of fox hunting is the martial ideal. It's practiced for war in a certain respect. And we know that men found it very much tied to the idea of masculinity. So yeah, that makes sense. That's one of the reasons that, you know, if you don't have a dog that can't do that, obviously that is therefore coding as unmasculine and is therefore feminine, and that's weird in itself. But yeah, absolutely. So hunting super popular. George Washington was also a very keen huntsman. One of his dogs was called Sweet Lips. Unusual choice for a dog name. I don't think I'd want to call that out in the park. But, you know,
you get some odd looks these days, wouldn't you?
Sorry?
You'd get some odd looks, wouldn't you?
You definitely would. Yeah, there are some quite weird 18th century dog names. I think that's probably the weirdest one of them. Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. So hunting. So dogs are really important to both elite men and elite women in this period, but in very different ways. So, I mean, the equivalent of the dog bonnet cloak setup would be the kennels of Goodwood, which were absolutely massive, and people were also quite disturbed about how much money had been spent on these, you know, Neo-Palladian kennels with different rooms, different places people sleep in, multiple packs. So yeah, so there were, I think that's the other thing, men were spending their money on dogs too, but because it was hunting, therefore it has kind of some kind of moral, not benefit, because I think Smith writes about hunting dogs being an example of not good spending, because you don't get the money back in any return. It's just basically you're throwing your money down a dog's throat, essentially, if you're keeping a pack of dogs that don't have any value in the long run. I think that's one of the reasons that obviously we don't have this separation anymore, but in the 18th century, there's a sense that the ideal dog for a man is a dog you can go hunting with and it can do things for you. And it's your companion in the field. Maybe it can come into your home sometimes and all the time. But yeah, so dogs are a big part of gender display for both men and women in quite different ways. I think maybe that's one of the reasons why people got really quite stressed out when men had small dogs rather than big dogs. It was considered a bit weird. In America, General Charles Lee had a Pomeranian dog called Spado or Spardo, and it went missing, and people were very mean to him about it for how much he liked his little dog. So people really had set ideas about what dogs were acceptable for which people, and if you strayed outside those gender lines, you'd be ripped apart for the doing it.
It's interesting what you say there about wasted money as well, even in relation to hunting dogs, which supposedly have a purpose, but then perhaps in some people's views don't have a purpose, and so on. If you're not spending your money on dogs, then what would they rather that you were spending your money on? Is it kind of, you know, you should be spending money on charitable causes? Is it that it should be invested to generate more wealth? What's the rationale that's going on there, that you can't spend your own money how you want to?
I think there's a certain question about taste in all of this. I think, and the idea that there's something really ostentatious about spending your money on something that's just there for display as people see it, and giving it things it doesn't necessarily need on top of that. I think there's a thing about charitable causes there is important, because in some of these kind of moralizing works for children, there's often, there's the bad lapdog owning woman with her pack of lapdogs and her parrot and her monkey, who doesn't do any charitable work in the community, and makes her servants do, she doesn't pay her servants very well, makes them do loads of unnecessary work, compared to the good mother who demonstrates the right way. So you beat your nice to local birds and you're nice with your dog, and you go out and do good deeds to the community. So I think charitable causes, and I think it's not the question of what you're spending money on, it's what you look like you're spending your money on lots of the time. I don't know what the ideal thing would be. Maybe a nice, tasteful, British-made product. I'm not sure, in short. I think often there's not even a suggestion of what you should be spending your money on. I think that, I know there's one tract written about dog food. It's not just about dog food, but dog food comes into it. And basically he calculates how much it costs to feed every dog, like his wife feeds her lap dog. And his point is very much that by taking away all the best bits of meat, you're raising the prices on them and therefore making it harder for less wealthy people to be able to afford them.
So we've already touched a little bit on it, Stephanie, about how you got into this topic. And I'm really curious about how you work something like this, how you get something out of it, what you move forward with it. So what are you going to be doing putting all of this together? What's your next steps, do you think, with all of these with all this wonderful information of dogs and pugs and just wonderful stuff?
With the assorted lap dogs, I'd really like to do a kind of a book for a popular readership about them, just because they're really interesting. They've been around for a really long time, and there's some really great stories there. But I think one of the things you need to do with the history of dogs is that it has to be a joint cultural social history of dogs. I think with dogs, so much of how we think and talk about them is from each other. Even if you have no experience of them, they're everywhere in our culture and they have been for the entire modern period. So you can't divorce books about dogs and films about dogs and poems about dogs and stories about dogs from our experiences of having dogs, just because, you know, even when you start when you're a very small child, they're everywhere in our culture. So that's the joint thing. At the same time, there's a tendency in some kinds of animal studies to just treat the animal as a symbol. And I think there's a danger of doing that here, because dogs are, having a dog, if you've had a dog, it's a multi-sensory experience. Like they bark, they poo where you don't want them to poo, they mate when you don't want them to mate. They're really smelly and they jump on things and they just mess everything up. So I think it's also important to keep in mind the dog's like a real being with its own behaviours, its own relationships, complicated or not, with other dogs and people it lives with. And I think, yeah, there's something really important to keep in mind when we're talking about any kind of animal. It's not just a thing that exists in our head. It's a real thing. And it meant something to the people you live with, if you're talking about a specific dog that belonged to a specific person. So, but yeah, I think if you think about, and the other thing about the 18th century, which is kind of the period I'm most interested in, is this one of the first periods where people begin writing novels about and from the perspective of dogs. So the first kind of dog book is by Cervantes, and comes a bit earlier. It's called The Dialogue of the Dogs, and basically two dogs are given the gift of speech for a single night, and they just chat to each other about all kinds of stuff that dogs like talking about, and this gets translated towards the 18th century in Britain. And you also have a book called Pompey the Little, which is about a Bolognese lapdog called Pompey, who's brought over to Britain. He kind of circulates throughout 18th century society, and he gives a kind of window onto all the different owners he lives with. And it was a really popular book in the 18th century. I think you can think about other kind of equivalent things today, if it's like Beverly Hills Chihuahua or something like that, like dogs are everywhere. And the stuff that is written about them and is still about them does influence people's perceptions of other dogs and the people who have them. So it has to be a joint social cultural thing. And yeah, it's like material culture. You've got your porcelain pugs in the 18th century. You've got your, I know, pug pajamas now, your pug cake or your French bulldog cake or whatever. So yeah, it has to be a multimedia project.
And you've been working on a big AHRC project. I'm always jealous when people have been working on AHRC projects, frankly. But yours is about pets and how their roles have changed in our lives, particularly in terms of the awareness of the benefits to pets on our well-being. So tell us a bit about what the project's been working to achieve and the exhibition that you've been putting together.
So the project, Pet Histories and Wellbeing, is run out of Royal Holloway, and it's led on from an earlier project that also had AHRC funding, but I didn't work on, called Pets and Family Life, which was all about looking at the Victorian period, saying we know that this is often pinpointed as a point of change in the way we own pet ownership. What does that actually mean for individual families? How do pets affect family life over a period from about 1837 to 1939? So pet histories and wellbeing has come out of that. And what we're doing, among other things, is we're working with the Museum of the Home, which has just reopened after a really long redevelopment and also a period of closure during COVID, on an exhibition called Pet Life, And what Pet Life is, it's an exhibition for families. And what you'll do, you'll go in, you choose one of four pets, two of which are Victorian, from this earlier Pets and Family Life project. And basically you follow its relationship with its owner or guardian, whatever you want to call them, within the home, and tells you a bit about their life with them. It runs from the 24th of July to the 1st of October, and you can book tickets online. So it's kind of like pets are so central to our concept of home and understanding family life that it makes perfect sense to work the Museum of the Home on a project on something like this, putting pets back into the home where they belong.
Just to round off, we were talking offline about the storytelling within this exhibition. So just tell us about one of these stories. Tell us about Starling Bob.
So like I said, there are four pets you can follow. Two are from Professor Jane Hamlett's research. So one is a skye terrier called Ruffy and the other one is this starling called Bob. I think Bob is quite interesting himself in the way that, although pets mean a lot to us, the way pet keeping has changed over the centuries. So pet starlings are a really common pet in Victorian England. But now you wouldn't have one because, as we know, it's not right to go into nature and take wild animals and tame them and keep them in the house. But we have featured him because his stories are interesting and he was a very talkative starling and he had a kind of sense of mischief. I think this is one of the challenges of doing public history for a family audience is that you want to, especially with something like animals, where there are obviously all these commonalities between how we treat our pets now and how people understood their pets then, that how we have very close relationships with them, but also the differences. You don't want to sand off that there are things that we did with animals in the past, 100, 200 years ago, that we wouldn't consider to be acceptable now. And that's history, isn't it? Where, you know, things change, people move on, ideas of what is acceptable change over time. And it's really interesting to kind of probe where those differences arise and what you do about them. So I think we've tried to think about what it would be like for the starling Bob to see normal starlings outside of the wild go about their daily business. So we want to represent the story accurately, but also not to undermine the fact that you really shouldn't keep a pet starling in the house and that there are ethical problems in doing so without changing the story massively. And same thing with the other stories we looked at. You wouldn't keep a terrier outside anymore. There was another one we considered doing but didn't do. It's about a woman who lived in Wapping when she was a young child, and she loved her family's pet cats, but the cat kept having babies. This is not in the exhibition. And obviously in the 1920s, if you're a poor family living in a tenement building in Wapping, you know, you can't spay your cat, and there's not a way you can reasonably go and euthanize those kittens normally. This is really dark, which is why it's really complicated. So yeah. But this person, this little girl, loved her adult cat and had really fond memories of cuddling with it. I think this is something if you talk to the older generation about, like your grandparents, the ideas of what was acceptable, what made you a good pet owner in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s changed. In fact, there's a historian called Hilda Keane who's written a lot about pets in the Second World War. And how there are kind of these mass euthanasia of pets because they were considered to be detrimental to the war effort to a certain extent. And it's this period of history that no one really talked about, and she did oral histories. It's really interesting. Animals are fascinating because they are cute and they are cuddly and they're interesting that way. But I think by just approaching them as cute and cuddly and not saying more complicated, you run into problems. I think this is true of things like social media today, where you see all those cute animal videos and you look into it, there's often quite a disturbing story behind it, where they're not showing natural behaviors or a natural situation, but because our human brains are wired to be like, oh, look at that little slow loris, so cute, so adorable, we don't really probe the stuff behind it. And the same with dog history. It's cute and cuddly, but there are other things coming off it about how we think about other dogs, how we think about people, what's appropriate for those people to do or not.
I think that's a really nice point to end on. Steph, thank you so much for this. We love doing different stuff on History Hack, and this has absolutely been completely left field to what a lot of people expect when we do history of the 18th century. But it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Any chance to talk about old historical dogs, especially ones that meet grisly ends for no reason? Thank you so much.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.